Ulysses. Though the boy had already read this story once from beginning to end, Ulysses asked him to read it again. Shortly after 10, with the sun having set, the moon yet to rise, and the others retreating to their tents, Billy had taken out his book and asked if Ulysses would like to hear the story of Ishmael, a young sailor who joined a one-legged captain on his hunt for a great white whale. Though Ulysses had never heard the story of Ishmael, he had no doubt it would be a good one. Each of the boy's stories had been good, but when Billy had offered to read this new adventure, with a touch of embarrassment, Ulysses had asked if he would read the story of his namesake instead. The boy hadn't hesitated. By the waning light of Stu's fire, he had turned to the back of his book and illuminated the page with his flashlight beam. A circle of light within a circle of light within a sea of darkness. As Billy began, Ulysses felt a moment of worry that, having read the story once before, the boy might paraphrase or skip over passages. But Billy seemed to understand that if the story was worth reading again, it was worth reading word for word. Yes, the boy read the story exactly as he had in the boxcar. But Ulysses didn't hear it the same way. For this time, he knew what was to come. He knew now to look forward to some parts and dread others, to look forward to how Ulysses bested the Cyclops by hiding his men under the pelts of sheep, and to dread the moment when the covetous crew unleashed the winds of Aeolus, setting their captain's ship off course at the very moment that his homeland had come into view. When the story was over, and Billy had closed his book and switched off his light, and Ulysses had taken up Stu's shovel to cover the embers, Billy asked if he would tell a story. Ulysses looked down with a smile. "I don't have any storybooks, Billy."
"You don't have to tell a story from a book," Billy replied. "You could tell a story from yourself, like one from the war overseas. Do you have any of those?"
Ulysses turned the shovel in his hand. Did he have any stories from the war? Of course he did, more than he cared to remember. For his stories had not been softened by the mists of time or brightened by the tropes of a poet. They remained vivid and severe, so vivid and severe that whenever one happened to surface in his mind, Ulysses would bury it, just as he had been about to bury the embers of this fire. If Ulysses couldn't stomach the sharing of the memories with himself, he certainly wasn't going to share them with an 8-year-old boy. But Billy's request was a fair one. Generously, he had opened the pages of his book and told the stories of Sinbad and Jason and Achilles and of Ulysses' namesake twice. He had certainly earned a telling in return. So, setting the shovel aside, Ulysses threw another log on the fire and resumed his seat on the railroad tie. "I have a story for you," he said. "A story about my own encounter with the King of the Winds."
"When you were sailing across the wine dark sea?"
"No," said Ulysses. "When I was walking across the dry and dusty land." The story began on a rural road in Iowa in the summer of 1952. A few days before, Ulysses had boarded a train in Utah, intending to travel over the Rockies and across the plains to Chicago. But halfway through Iowa, the boxcar in which he was traveling was shunted onto a siding in order to wait for a different locomotive, which was scheduled to arrive who knew when. 40 miles away was the junction in Des Moines, where he could easily catch another train headed east, or one headed north toward the lakes, or south to New Orleans. With that in mind, Ulysses had disembarked and begun working his way across the countryside on foot. He had walked about 10 miles down an old dirt road when he began to sense that something was amiss. The first sign was the birds, or rather the absence of them. When you're traveling back and forth across the country, Ulysses explained. The one great constant is the companionship of birds. On your way from Miami to Seattle or Boston to San Diego, the landscape is always changing. But wherever you go, the birds are there. The pigeons or buzzards, condors or cardinals, blue jays or blackbirds. Living on the road, you wake to the sound of their singing at dawn, and you lay yourself down to their chatter at dusk. And yet, as Ulysses walked along this rural road, there wasn't a bird to be seen, not circling over the fields or perched upon the telephone wires. The second sign was the caravan of cars. While throughout the morning Ulysses had been passed by the occasional pickup or sedan moving along at 40 miles an hour, suddenly he saw an assortment of 15 cars, including a black limousine, speeding in his direction. The vehicles were driving so fast he had to step off the shoulder in order to shield himself from the gravel that was kicked up by their tires. After watching them race past, Ulysses turned back to look in the direction from which they'd come. That's when he saw that the sky in the east was turning from blue to green, which in that part of the country, as Billy well knew, could only mean one thing. Behind Ulysses was nothing but knee-high corn for as far as the eye could see, but half a mile ahead was a farmhouse. With the sky growing darker by the minute, Ulysses began to run. As he drew closer, Ulysses could see that the farmhouse had already been battened down, its doors and shutters closed. He could see the owner securing the barn, then dashing to the hatch of his shelter, where his wife and children waited. And when the farmer reached his family, Ulysses could see the young boy pointing in his direction. As the four looked his way, Ulysses slowed from a run to a walk with his hands at his side. The farmer instructed his wife and children to go into the shelter, first the wife so that she could help the children, then the daughter, and then the little boy, who continued to look at Ulysses right up until the moment he disappeared from sight. Ulysses expected the father to follow his family down the ladder, but leaning over to say one last thing, he closed the hatch, turned toward Ulysses, and waited for his approach. Maybe there was no lock on the shelter's hatch, thought Ulysses, and the farmer figured if there was going to be a confrontation, then better to have it now while still above ground. Or maybe he felt if one man intends to refuse harbor to another, he should do so face to face. As a sign of respect, Ulysses came to a stop 6 paces away, close enough to be heard, but far enough to pose no threat. The two men studied each other as the wind began to lift the dust around their feet. "I'm not from around these parts," Ulysses said after a moment. "I'm just a Christian working my way to Des Moines so I can catch a train." The farmer nodded. He nodded in a manner that said he believed Ulysses was a Christian and that he was on his way to catch a train, but that under the circumstances, neither of those things mattered. "I don't know you," he said simply.
"No, you don't," agreed Ulysses.
For a moment, Ulysses considered helping the man come to know him by telling him his name, telling him that he'd been raised in Tennessee and that he was a veteran, that he'd once had a wife and child of his own. But even as these thoughts passed through Ulysses' mind, he knew that the telling of them wouldn't matter either, and he knew it without resentment. For were the positions reversed, were Ulysses about to climb down into a shelter, a windowless space beneath the ground that he had dug with his own hands for the safety of his family, and were a 6-foot-tall white man suddenly to appear, he wouldn't have welcomed him either. He would have sent him on his way. After all, what was a man in the prime of his life doing crossing the country on foot with nothing but a canvas bag slung over his shoulder? A man like that must have made certain choices. He had chosen to abandon his family, his township, his church, in pursuit of something different, in pursuit of a life unhindered, unanswered, and alone. Well, if that's what he had worked so hard to become, then why, in a moment like this, should he expect to be treated as anything different?
"I understand,"
said Ulysses, though the man had not explained himself. The farmer looked at Ulysses for a moment, and turning to his right, he pointed to a thin white spire rising from a grove of trees. The Unitarian Church is a little less than a mile. It's got a basement, and you've got a good chance of making it if you run.
Thank you, said Ulysses.
As they stood facing each other, Ulysses knew that the farmer had been right. Any chance he had of making it to the church in time was predicated on his going as quickly as he could. But Ulysses had no intention of breaking into a run in front of another man, however good his advice. It was a matter of dignity. After waiting, the farmer seemed to understand this, and with a shake of the head that laid no blame on anyone, including himself, he opened his hatch and joined his family. With a glance at the steeple, Ulysses could tell that the shortest route to the church was directly across the fields rather than by way of the road, so that's the way he went, running as the crow would fly. It didn't take long for him to realize that this was a mistake. Though the corn was only a foot and a half high and the farmer's rows were wide and well-kept, the ground itself was soft and uneven, making for cumbersome work. Given all the fields he'd slogged across in Italy, he should have known better. But it seemed too late to switch back to the road now, so with his eye on the steeple, he pressed ahead as best he could. When he was halfway to the church, the twister appeared in the distance at 2 o'clock, a dark black finger reaching down from the sky, the inversion of the steeple both in color and intent. With every step now, Ulysses' progress was slowing. There was so much debris kicking up from the ground that he had to advance with a hand in front of his face to protect his eyes. Then he was holding up both hands with his gaze partly averted as he stumbled onward toward the upward and downward spires. Through the gaps in his fingers, in the veil of the unsettled dust, Ulysses became aware of rectangular shadows rising from the ground around him, shadows that looked at once orderly and in disarray. Dropping his hands for a second, he realized he had entered a graveyard and he could hear the bell in the steeple beginning to toll as if rung by an invisible hand. He couldn't have been more than 50 yards from the church, but in all likelihood, it was 50 yards too far. For the twister was turning counterclockwise, and its winds were pushing Ulysses away from his goal rather than toward it. As hail began raining down upon him, he prepared for one final push. I can make it, he told himself. Then running with all his might, he began closing the distance between himself and the sanctuary, only to stumble over a low-lying gravestone and come crashing to the ground with the bitter resignation of the abandoned.
Abandoned by who?
Asked Billy, with his book gripped in his lap and his eyes open wide. Ulysses smiled. I don't know, Billy. By fortune, by fate, by my own good sense, but mostly by God. The boy began shaking his head.
You don't mean that, Ulysses. You don't mean that you were abandoned by God.
But that's exactly what I mean, Billy. If I learned anything in the war, it's that the point of utter abandonment, that moment at which you realize no one will be coming to your aid, not even your maker, is the very moment in which you may discover the strength required to carry on. The good Lord does not call you to your feet with hymns from the cherubim and Gabriel blowing his horn. He calls you to your feet by making you feel alone and forgotten. For only when you have seen that you are truly forsaken will you embrace the fact that what happens next rests in your hands, and your hands alone. Lying on the ground of that graveyard, feeling the old abandonment and knowing it for what it was, Ulysses reached up and took hold of the top of the nearest gravestone. As he hoisted himself upward, he realized the stone he was pushing on was not weathered or worn. Even through the maelstrom of dust and debris, he could see it had the dark gray luminescence of a stone that had just been planted. Rising to his full height, Ulysses found himself looking over the shoulders of the marker, down into a freshly dug grave, at the bottom of which was the shiny black top of a casket.
This is where the caravan of cars had been coming from, realized Ulysses. They must have been right in the middle of the internment when they received warning of the tornado's approach. The Reverend must have hurried through whatever verses would suffice to commit the soul of the deceased to heaven, and then everyone had dashed for their cars. From the look of the coffin, it must have been for a man of some wealth, for this was no pine box. It was polished mahogany with handles of solid brass. On the lid of the coffin was a matching brass plaque with the dead man's name, Noah Benjamin Elias. Sliding down into the narrow gap between the coffin and the wall of the grave, Ulysses bent over to unscrew the clasps and open the coffin's lid. Inside was Mr. Elias lying in state, dressed in a three-piece suit with hands crossed neatly on his chest. His shoes were as black and shiny as his coffin, and curving across his vest was the thin gold chain of a watch. Though only about 5'6", Mr. Elias must have weighed over 200 pounds, having dined in a manner suited to his station. What was the nature of Mr. Elias's earthly success? Was he the owner of a bank or lumber yard? Was he a man of grit and determination, or of greed and deceit? Whichever he was no longer. And all that mattered to Ulysses was that this man, who was only 5'6", had had a big enough sense of himself to be buried in a coffin that was 6 feet long. Reaching down, Ulysses took hold of Elias by the lapels, just as you would when you intended to shake some sense into someone. Pulling him up out of the coffin, Ulysses hoisted him into a standing position so that they were almost face to face. Ulysses could see now that the mortician had applied rouge on the dead man's cheeks and scented him with gardenia, giving him the unsettling semblance of a harlot. Bending his knees in order to get under the weight of the cadaver, Ulysses raised him up out of his resting place and dumped him at the side of the grave. Taking one last look at the great black finger that was swaying left and right as it bore down upon him, Ulysses lay back in the pleated white silk that lined the empty coffin, reached up a hand, and...
Pastor John. When the vengeance of the Lord is visited upon us, it does not rain down from the heavens like a shower of meteors trailing fire. It does not strike like a bolt of lightning accompanied by claps of thunder. It does not gather like a tidal wave far out at sea and come crashing down upon the shores. No. When the vengeance of the Lord is visited upon us, it begins as a breath in the desert. Gentle and undaunting, this little expiration turns 3 times above the hardened ground, quietly stirring the dust and the scent of the sagebrush. But as it turns 3 times more, and 3 times again, this little whirlwind grows to the size of a man and begins to move. Spiraling across the land, it gains in velocity and volume, growing to the size of a colossus, swaying and sweeping up into its vortex all that lays within its path. First the sand and stones, the shrubs and varmints, and then the works of men. Until at long last, towering 100 feet tall and moving at 100 miles an hour, swirling and spinning, turning and twisting, it comes inexorably for the sinner. Thus concluded the thoughts of Pastor John, as he stepped from the darkness and swung his oaken staff in order to smite the negro called Ulysses on the crown of his head. Left for dead. That's what Pastor John had been. With the tendons of his right knee torn, the skin of his cheeks abraded, his right eye swollen shut, he lay among the bushes and brambles preparing to deliver his own absolution. But at the very moment of his demise, the Lord had found him by the side of the tracks and breathed new life into his limbs. Lifting him up from the gravel and scrub, he had carried him to the edge of a cool running stream, where his thirst was slaked, his wounds washed, and into his hands delivered the branch of an ancient oak to be used as a staff. In the hours that followed, not once did Pastor John wonder where he was going, how he would get there, or to what end, for he could feel the Spirit of the Lord working through him, making of him its instrument. From the riverbank, It led him back through the woods to a siding where 10 empty boxcars had been left unattended. Once he was safely inside, it brought forth a locomotive that hitched the cars and carried him eastward to the city of New York. When Pastor John disembarked in the great rail yard situated between Pennsylvania Station and the Hudson River, the spirit shielded him from the eyes of the railway guards and led him not into the crowded streets, but up onto the tracks of an elevated line. With his weight on his staff in order to spare his knee, Pastor John moved along the elevated, casting his shadow down upon the avenues. Once the sun had set, the spirit led him onward, through an empty warehouse, through a gap in a fence, through the high and scraggly grass, through the darkness itself, until in the distance he could see a campfire shining like a star. Drawing closer, Pastor John saw that in his infinite wisdom, the good Lord had lit the fire not only to guide him, but to illuminate the faces of the Negro and the boy, even as it made Pastor John's presence invisible to them. In the shadows outside the circle of the fire, Pastor John stopped and listened, as the boy finished a story and asked if the Negro would tell one of his own. Oh, how John had laughed to hear Ulysses rattle on about his frightful tornado. For that little twister was nothing compared to the widening gyre, which is the vengeance of the Lord. Did he seriously think that he could throw a pastor from a moving train without fear of retribution? That his actions would somehow escape the eyes of the divine and the hand of judgment? The Lord God is all-seeing and all-knowing, Pastor John said without speaking. He has paid witness to your misdeeds, Ulysses. He has paid witness to your arrogance and trespass. And he has brought me here to deliver his reprisal. With such fury did the Spirit of the Lord breathe into the limbs of Pastor John. When he brought his oaken staff down upon the Negro's head, the force of the blow snapped the staff in two. When Ulysses slumped to the ground, and Pastor John stepped into the light, the boy, complicit with the Negro at every step, stretched out his hands in the silent horror of the damned. "May I join you by your fire?" asked the pastor with a loud and hearty laugh. His staff truncated, Pastor John was forced to limp toward the boy. But this didn't worry him, for he knew the boy would go nowhere and say nothing. Rather, he would withdraw into himself like a snail into its shell. Sure enough, when Pastor John pulled him up by the collar of his shirt, he could see that the boy had clenched his eyes closed and begun his incantation. "There is no Emmet here," said the pastor. "No one is coming to your aid, William Watson." And with the boy's collar fast in his grip, Pastor John raised the broken staff and prepared to deliver that lesson which Ulysses had interrupted 2 days before, to deliver it with interest. But just when the staff was poised to fall, the boy opened his eyes. "I am truly forsaken," he said with a mysterious gusto. Then he kicked the pastor in his injured knee. With an animal howl, Pastor John let loose the boy's shirt and dropped his staff. Hopping in place with tears of pain falling from his one good eye, Pastor John became more committed in his intent to teach the boy a lesson he wouldn't soon forget. But even as he thrust his hands outward, he could see through his tears that the boy was gone. Eager to pursue, Pastor John looked frantically about for something to replace his broken staff. "Aha!" he shouted, for there on the ground was a shovel. Picking it up, Pastor John stuck the blade into the dirt, leaned on the handle, and began moving slowly toward the darkness into which the boy had disappeared. After a few steps, he could just make out the silhouettes of an encampment, a small pile of firewood covered with a tarp, a makeshift washstand, a line of 3 empty bedrolls, and a tent. "William," he called softly. "Where are you, William?"
"What's going on out there?"
came a voice from inside the tent. Holding his breath, Pastor John took a step to the side and waited as a stocky Negro emerged. Not seeing the pastor, he walked a few feet forward and stopped.
"Ulysses?"
he asked. When Pastor John hit him with the flat of the shovel, he fell to the ground with a groan. Off to his left, Pastor John could hear other voices now, the voices of 2 men who may have heard the commotion.
"Forget the boy," he said to himself.
Using the shovel as his crutch, he hobbled as quickly as he could back to the campfire and made his way to where the boy had been sitting. There on the ground were the book and the flashlight. But where was that damnable rucksack? Pastor John looked back in the direction from which he had just come. Could it have been by the bedrolls? No. Where the book and the flashlight were, the rucksack was sure to be. Leaning over carefully, Pastor John dropped the shovel, picked up the flashlight, and switched it on. With a hop, he trained the beam onto the backside of the railroad ties and began moving from right to left. There it is. Sitting down on a tie with his injured leg stretched before him, Pastor John retrieved the rucksack and set it in his lap. Even as he did so, he could hear the music within. With growing excitement, he undid the straps and began withdrawing items and tossing them aside. Two shirts, a pair of pants, a washcloth. At the very bottom, he found the tin. Liberating it from the bag, he gave it a celebratory shake. Tomorrow morning, he would pay a visit to the Jews on 47th Street. In the afternoon, he would go to a department store for a new set of clothes. And tomorrow night, he would check into a fine hotel, where he would take a long, hot bath and send out for oysters, a bottle of wine, perhaps even some female companionship. But now it was time to leave. Returning the flashlight and tin to the rucksack, he cinched its straps and hooked it over his shoulder. Ready at last to be on his way, Pastor John leaned to his left in order to pick up the shovel, only to find that it was no longer where he had...
Ulysses. First there was darkness without recognition. Then slowly, an awareness of it. An awareness that it wasn't the darkness of space, cold, vast, and remote. It was a darkness that was close and warm. A darkness that was covering him, embracing him in the manner of a velvet shroud. Creeping from the corners of his memory came the realization that he was still in the fat man's coffin. He could feel along his shoulders the smooth, pleated silk of the lining and, behind that, the sturdiness of the mahogany frame. He wanted to raise the lid, but how much time had passed? Was the tornado gone? Holding his breath, he listened. He listened through the pleated silk and polished mahogany and heard nothing. Not the sound of the wind whistling, or of hail falling on the coffin lid, or of the church bell swinging on its hook unattended. In order to be certain, he decided to open the coffin a crack. Turning his palms upward, he pressed at the lid, but the lid wouldn't budge. Was it possible that he had become weakened with hunger and fatigue? Surely not that much time had passed. Or had it? Suddenly, it occurred to him with a touch of horror that in the aftermath of the storm, while he was unconscious, someone might have happened upon the open grave and shoveled the mound of topsoil onto the coffin, finishing the job. He would have to try again, after rolling his shoulders and flexing his fingers in order to restore the circulation to his limbs. He drew a breath, put his palms again against the inner surface of the lid, and pushed with all his might as the sweat that formed on his brow ran in droplets into his eyes. Slowly, the lid began to open, and cooler air rushed into the coffin. With a sense of relief, Ulysses gathered his strength and pushed the lid all the way back, expecting to be gazing up into the afternoon sky. But it wasn't the afternoon. It looked to be the middle of the night. Raising a hand gently in the air, he saw that his skin reflected a flickering light. Listening, he heard the long, hollow horn of a ship and the laughter of a gull as if he were somewhere at sea. But then, coming from a short distance, he heard a voice, the voice of a boy declaring his forsakenness, the voice of Billy Watson. And suddenly, Ulysses knew where he was. An instant later, he heard a grown man howling in anger or in pain, And though Ulysses didn't yet understand what had happened to himself, he knew what he must do. Having rolled onto his side with a great sluggish effort, he raised himself onto his knees. Wiping the sweat from his eyes, he discovered by the light of the fire that it was blood, not sweat. Someone had hit him on the head. Rising to his feet, Ulysses looked around the fire for Billy and for the man who had howled, but no one was there. He wanted to call out for Billy, but understood that to do so would signal to an unknown enemy that he had regained consciousness. He needed to get away from the fire, outside of the circle of light. Under the veil of darkness, he would be able to gather his wits and strength, find Billy, and then begin the process of hunting his adversary down. Stepping over one of the railroad ties, he walked 5 paces into the darkness and took his bearings. There was the river, he thought, turning on his feet. There was the Empire State Building, and there was their encampment. As he looked in the direction of Stu's tent, he thought he saw movement. Quietly, almost too softly to hear, came the voice of a man calling Billy, calling him by his given name. The man's voice may have been almost too soft to hear, but it wasn't too soft to recognize. While remaining in the darkness, Ulysses began circumventing the fire, moving carefully, quietly, inevitably, toward the preacher. Ulysses stopped short when he heard Stu call his name. A moment later, he heard the clang of metal and the thud of a body falling to the ground. Feeling a flash of anger with himself for being too cautious, Ulysses prepared to charge into the encampment when he saw a silhouette emerge from the darkness, moving unevenly. It was the preacher using Stu's shovel as a crutch. Dropping the shovel on the ground, he picked up the boy's flashlight, switched it on, and began searching for something. Keeping an eye on the preacher, Ulysses crept to the edge of the fire, reached over a railroad tie, and retrieved the shovel. When the preacher gave an exclamation of discovery, Ulysses stepped back into the darkness and watched as he picked up Billy's knapsack and sat with it in his lap. In an excited voice, the preacher began talking to himself about hotels and oysters and female companionship while withdrawing Billy's belongings and tossing them on the ground, until he found the $10. At the same time, Ulysses began moving forward until he was directly behind the preacher, and when the preacher, having slung the knapsack over his shoulder, leaned to his left, Ulysses brought the shovel down. With the preacher now lying in a heap at his feet, Ulysses felt himself heaving. Given his own injury, the effort to subdue the preacher had taken all his immediate strength. Worried that he might even faint, Ulysses stabbed the shovel into the ground and leaned on its hilt as he looked down to make certain the preacher was unmoving.
Is he dead?
It was Billy, standing at his side, looking down at the preacher too. No, said Ulysses. Astoundingly, the boy seemed relieved.
Are you all right?
Asked Billy. Yes, said Ulysses. Are you? Billy nodded.
I did like you said, Ulysses. When Pastor John told me that I was alone, I imagined that I had been forsaken by everyone, including my maker. Then I kicked him and hid beneath the firewood tarp.
Ulysses smiled. You did well, Billy.
What the hell is going on?
Billy and Ulysses looked up to find Stu standing behind them with a butcher knife in hand.
You're bleeding too,
Billy said with concern. Stu had been hit on the side of the head, so the blood had run down from his ear onto the shoulder of his undershirt. Ulysses was suddenly feeling better now, more clear-headed and sure of foot. Billy, he said, why don't you go over there and fetch us the basin of water and some towels? Sticking his knife through his belt, Stu came alongside Ulysses and looked at the ground. Who is it? A man of ill intent, said Ulysses. Stu shifted his gaze to Ulysses' head.
You better let me take a look at that. I've had worse. We've all had worse.
I'll be all right,
I know, said Stu with a shake of the head. You're a big, big man.
Billy arrived with the basin and towels. The two men cleaned their faces and then gingerly dabbed at their wounds. When they were done, Ulysses sat Billy down beside him in one of the railroad ties.
Billy, he began, we've had quite a bit of excitement tonight.
Billy nodded in agreement.
Yes, we have, Ulysses. Emmett will hardly believe it.
Well, that's just what I wanted to talk to you about. What with your brother trying to find his car and having to get you to California before the 4th of July, he's got a lot on his mind. Maybe it's for the best if we keep what happened here tonight between us, at least for now.
Billy was nodding.
It's probably for the best,
he said.
Emmett has a lot on his mind.
Ulysses patted Billy on the knee.
One day, he said, you will tell him.
You will tell him and your children, too,
about how you bested the preacher, just like one of the heroes in your book.
When Ulysses saw that Billy understood, he got up and ordered to speak with Stu.
Can you take the boy back to your tent?
Maybe give him something to eat.
All right.
But what are you going to do?
I'm going to see to the preacher.
Billy, who had been listening behind Ulysses' back, stepped around him with a look of concern.
What does that mean, Ulysses? What does that mean, you're going to see to the preacher?
Ulysses and Stu looked from the boy to each other and back again.
We can't leave him here, explained Ulysses. He's going to come too, just like I did, and whatever villainy had been on his mind before I crowned him is going to be there still, only more so.
Billy was looking up at Ulysses with a furrowed brow.
So, continued Ulysses, I'm going to take him down the stairs and drop him—
At the police station?
That's right, Billy. I'm going to drop him at the police station.
Billy nodded to indicate that this was the right thing to do. Then Stu turned to Ulysses.
You know the stairs that go down to Gansevoort?
I do.
Someone's meant back the fencing there. It'll be an easier route, given what you'll be carrying.
Thanking Stu, Ulysses waited for Billy to gather his things, for Stu to put out the fire, and for the two to go back to Stu's tent before he turned his attention to the preacher.
Taking him under the armpits, Ulysses raised him up and draped him over his shoulders.
The preacher wasn't heavier than Ulysses had expected, but he was gangly, making him an awkward burden.
Shifting the body back and forth by increments, Ulysses tried to center it before he began walking in short, steady strides. When he reached the staircase, if Ulysses had stopped to think, he might have rolled the preacher down the steps to preserve his own strength. But he was moving now, and he had the preacher's weight evenly distributed across his shoulders, and he was worried that if he stopped, he might lose his balance or his momentum, and he would need them both. Because from the bottom of the stairs, it was a good 200 yards to the river.
Duchess. Wooly's sister came into the kitchen like a ghost, appearing in the doorway in her long white robe and crossing the unlit room without a sound. It was like her feet didn't touch the floor. But if she was a ghost, she wasn't the harrowing sort, one of those that howl and moan and send shivers down your spine. She was the forlorn sort, the kind of ghost who wanders the halls of an empty house for generations in search of something or someone that no one else can even remember. A visitation, I think they call it. Yeah, that's it, a visitation. Without switching on the light, she filled the kettle and turned on the burner. From the cabinet, she took out a mug and a tea bag and set them on the counter. From the pocket of her robe, she took out a little brown bottle and set it beside the mug. Then she went back to the sink and stood there looking out the window. You got the sense that she was good at looking out the window, like maybe she'd gotten a lot of practice. She didn't fidget or tap her feet. In fact, she was so good at it, so good at getting lost in her thoughts,
that when the kettle whistled, it seemed to catch her by surprise, as if she couldn't remember having turned it on in the first place. Slowly, almost reluctantly, she left her spot at the window, poured the water, picked up the mug in one hand and the little brown bottle in the other, and turned toward the table. "Trouble sleeping?" I asked. Caught off guard, she didn't cry out or drop her tea. She just gave the same little expression of surprise that she had given when the kettle whistled. "I didn't see you there," she said, slipping the little brown bottle back in the pocket of her robe. She hadn't answered my question about whether she had trouble sleeping, but she didn't need to. Every aspect of the way she moved in the dark, crossing the room, filling the pot, lighting the stove, suggested this was something of a routine. It wouldn't have surprised me in the least to learn that every other night she came down to the kitchen at 2 a.m. while her husband slept soundly, none the wiser. Gesturing back toward the stove, she asked if I'd like some tea. I pointed to the glass in front of me. "I found a little whiskey in the living room. I hope you don't mind." She smiled softly. "Of course not." After taking the seat opposite mine, she trained her gaze on my left eye. "How does it feel?" "Much better, thanks." I had left Harlem in such high spirits that when I got back to Wooly's sister's house, I'd completely forgotten the beating I'd taken. When she answered the door and gasped, I practically gasped back. But once Wooly had made the introductions and I had explained the spill I'd taken in the train station, she got a cute little first aid kit out of her medicine cabinet, sat me here at the kitchen table, cleaned the blood off my lip, and gave me a bag of frozen peas to hold over my eye. I would have preferred using a raw steak like a heavyweight champ, but beggars can't be choosers. "Would you like another aspirin?" she asked. "No, I'll be all right." We were both quiet for a moment, as I took a sip of her husband's whiskey and she took a sip of her tea. "You're Wooly's bunkmate?" "That's right." "So was it your father who was on the stage?" "He was under it as often as he was on it," I said with a smile. "But yeah, that's my old man. He started out as a Shakespearean and ended up doing vaudeville." She smiled at the word vaudeville. "Wooly has written to me about some of the performers your father worked with, the escape artists and magicians. He was quite taken with them." "Your brother loves a good bedtime story." "Yes, he does, doesn't he?" She looked across the table as if she wanted to ask me something, but then shifted her gaze to the tea. "What?" I prompted. "It was a personal question. Those are the best kind." She studied me for a moment, trying to gauge whether or not I was being sincere. She must have decided I was. "How did you end up at Selina, Duchess?"
"Oh, that's a long one.
I've barely started my tea."
So having poured myself another finger of whiskey, I recounted my little comedy, thinking maybe everyone in Wooly's family liked a good bedtime tale.
It was in the spring of 1952, just a few weeks after my 16th birthday, and we were living in room 42 at the Sunshine Hotel, with Pops on the bedsprings and me on the floor. At the time, my old man was what he liked to call betwixt and between, which just meant that having gotten fired from one job, he'd yet to find the next job to get fired from. He was spending his days with his old pal Fitzy, who was living across the hall. In the early afternoons, they would shuffle off to scour around the park benches, fruit carts, newsstands, and any other spots where someone was likely to drop a nickel and not bother to pick it back up. Then they would head down into the subways and sing sentimental songs with their hats in their hands. Men who knew their audience, they would perform Danny Boy for the Irish on the Third Avenue line and Ave Maria for the Italians at Spring Street Station, crying their eyes out like they meant every word. They even had a Yiddish number about the days in the shtetl that they'd roll out when they were on the platform of the Canal Street stop. Then in the evenings, after giving me 2 bits and sending me off to a double feature, they would take their hard-earned pay to a dive on Elizabeth Street and drink every last penny of it. Since the two of them didn't get up until noon, when I woke in the morning, I would wander the hotel looking for something to eat or someone to talk to. At that hour, it was pretty slim pickings, but there were a handful of early risers, and the best of them, without a doubt, was Marceline Maupassant. Back in the 20s, Marceline had been one of the most famous clowns in Europe, performing for sold-out runs in Paris and Berlin, complete with standing ovations and lines of women waiting at the backstage door. To be sure, Marceline was no ordinary clown. He wasn't a guy who painted his face and tromped around in oversized shoes honking a horn. He was the real McCoy, a poet and a dancer, a man who observed the world closely and felt things deeply, like Chaplin and Keaton. One of his greatest bits was as a panhandler on a bustling city street. When the curtain came up, there he would be, navigating a crowd of metropolitans. With a little bow, he would try to get the attention of two men arguing over headlines by the newsstand. With a doff of his crooked hat, he would try to address a nanny whose mind was on the colicky baby in her care. Whether with a doff or a bow, everyone he tried to engage would go about their business as if he weren't even there. Then when Marceline was about to approach a shy young woman with a downcast expression, a nearsighted scholar would bump into him, knocking his hat from his head. Off in pursuit of the hat, Marceline would go. But each time he was about to grab it, a distracted pedestrian would send it skidding in the other direction. After making several attempts at retrieval, to his utter dismay, Marceline would realize that a rotund police officer was about to step on the hat unawares. With no other choice, Marceline would raise a hand in the air, snap his fingers, and everyone would be frozen in place. Everyone, that is, except Marceline. Now the magic would happen. For a few minutes, Marceline would glide about the stage, skating in between the immobile pedestrians with a delicate smile, as if he hadn't a care in the world. And taking a long-stemmed rose from the flower vendor, he would present it shyly to the downcast young woman. He would interject a point or two to the two men who were arguing by the newsstand. He would make faces for the baby in the pram. He would laugh and comment and counsel, all without making a sound. But as Marceline was about to make another circuit through the crowd, he would hear a delicate chiming. Stopping at center stage, he would reach into his shabby vest and remove a solid gold pocket watch, clearly a vestige from another time in his life. Popping the lid, he would regard the hour and realize with a doleful look that his little game had gone on long enough. Putting the watch away, he would carefully take his crooked hat from under the fat policeman's foot, which had been hovering in the air for all this time, a feat of gymnastics in itself. Brushing it off, he would place it on his head, face the audience, snap his fingers, and all the activities of his fellow men would resume. It was an act worth seeing more than once, because the first time you saw the show, when Marceline snapped his fingers at the end, it would seem like the world had gone right back to the way it was. But the second or third time you saw it, you might begin to realize that the world wasn't exactly the way it was. As the shy young woman is walking away, she smiles to discover the long-stemmed rose in her hands. The two men debating by the newsstand pause in their arguments, suddenly less sure of their positions. The nanny was trying so diligently to appease her crying charge is startled to find him giggling. If you went to see Marceline's performance more than once, all of this you might notice in the seconds before the curtain came down. In the fall of 1929, at the height of his fame in Europe, Marceline was lured to New York by the promise of a six-figure contract for a six-month residency at the Hippodrome. With all the enthusiasm of an artist, he packed his bags for an extended stay in the land of the free. But as it so happened, the very moment that he was boarding his steamship in Bremen, the stock market on Wall Street had begun its precipitous plunge. By the time he disembarked on the West Side piers, his American producers had been ruined. The Hippodrome was closed, and his contract was canceled. A telegram waiting for him at his hotel from his bankers in Paris informed him that he, too, had lost everything in the crash, leaving not even enough for a safe passage home. And when he knocked on the doors of other producers, he discovered that despite his fame in Europe, virtually no one in America knew who he was. Now what had been knocked from Marceline's head was his self-esteem. And every time he leaned over to pick it back up, a passing pedestrian would kick it out of reach. Off in pursuit of it he went, from one sorry spot to the next, until at long last he found himself performing pantomimes on street corners and living in the Sunshine Hotel, right down the hall, in room 49. Naturally enough, Marceline became a drinker, but not in the fashion of Fitzy and my old man. He wouldn't go to some dive where he could relive old glories and air old complaints. In the evenings, he'd buy a bottle of cheap red wine and drink it alone in his room with the door closed, refilling his glass in a smooth, elaborate motion, as if it were part of the act. But in the mornings, he would leave his door ajar, and when I gave it a tap, he would welcome me with a doff of the hat that he no longer owned. Sometimes, if he had a little money on hand, he would send me out for milk, flour, and eggs, and cook us tiny little crepes on the bottom of an electric iron. And as we ate our breakfast sitting on his floor, rather than talk about his past, he would ask about my future, about all the places I would go and all the things I would do. It was a grand old way to start the day. And one morning when I went down the hall, his door wasn't ajar. And when I tapped, there wasn't an answer. Placing an ear against the wood, I heard the slightest creaking, like someone turning on the bedsprings. Worried he might be sick, I opened the door a crack. "Mr. Marceline?" I said. When he didn't reply, I opened the door the rest of the way, only to find that the bed hadn't been slept in, the desk chair was toppled over in the middle of the room, and Marceline was hanging from the ceiling fan. The creaking, you see, hadn't come from the bedsprings. It had come from the weight of his body turning slowly back and forth. When I woke my father and brought him to the room, he simply nodded his head, as if it were what he had expected all along. Then he sent me down to the front desk to have them call the authorities. Half an hour later, there were three policemen in the room, two patrolmen and a detective taking statements from me and my father and the neighboring tenants who'd come poking their heads through the door. "Was he robbed?" one of the tenants asked. By way of response, a patrolman gestured to Marceline's desk, where the contents of his pockets had been laid out, including a $5 bill and some change. "Then where's the watch?"
"What watch?"
asked the detective. Everyone began talking at once, explaining about the solid gold pocket watch that had been so central to the old clown's act that he had never been willing to part with it, not even when he was broke. After looking at the patrolmen, who shook their heads, the detective looked at my father. Then my father looked at me. "Now, Duchess," he said, placing an arm over my shoulder, "this is very important. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to tell me the truth. When you found Marceline, did you see his watch?" Silently, I shook my head. "Maybe you found it on the floor," he suggested helpfully, "and you picked it up so it wouldn't get broken." "No," I said with another shake of the head. "I never saw his watch." Patting me on the shoulder almost sympathetically, my father turned to the detective and gave the shrug of one who's tried his best.
"Search them," said the detective.
Imagine my surprise when the patrolman asked me to turn out my pockets, and there, among the gum wrappers, was a golden watch on a long golden chain. Imagine my surprise, I say, because I was surprised, stunned, astounded even, for all of 2 seconds. After that, it was plain as day what had happened. My old man had sent me downstairs to the front desk so that he could frisk the body. And when the watch was mentioned by the meddlesome neighbor, my father had draped his arm over my shoulder and given his little speech so that he could slip it into my pocket before he was patted down. "Oh, Duchess," he said with such disappointment. Within the hour, I was at the police station. As a minor committing his first offense, I was a good candidate for being released into my father's care. But given the value of the old clown's watch, the crime wasn't petty theft. It was grand larceny. To make matters worse, there had been reports of a few other thefts at the Sunshine Hotel. And Fitzy claimed in a sworn statement that he had seen me coming out of one or two rooms in which I didn't belong. As if that weren't enough, the people from Child Services discovered, to my father's utter shock, that I hadn't been to school in 5 years. When I appeared before the juvenile judge, my father was forced to admit that as a hard-working widower, he was not in a position to protect me from the malevolent influences of the Bowery. For my own good, all agreed, I should be placed in a juvenile reform program until the age of 18. When the judge delivered his decision, my father asked if he could offer a few words of advice to his wayward son before I was carted away. The judge acquiesced, probably assuming that my father would take me aside and be quick about it. Instead, my old man stuck his thumbs under his suspenders, puffed out his chest, and addressed the judge, the bailiff, the peanut gallery, and the stenographer, especially the stenographer.
"As we part, my son," he said to one and all, "my blessing goes with thee. But in my absence carry with you these few precepts. Be thou familiar, but by no means vulgar. Give every man thy ear, but few thy voice. Take every man's censure, but reserve thy judgment. And this above all, to thine own self be true. For then it must follow, as night follows day, that thou cannot be false to any man. Farewell, my son," he concluded. "Farewell." And as they led me from the room, he actually shed a tear, the old fox.
"How terrible," said Sarah. And I could see from her face that she meant it. Her expression had suggestions of sympathy, indignation, and protectiveness. You could just tell that whether or not she became happy in her own life, she was bound to be a wonderful mother. "It's okay," I said, trying to ease her distress. "Selena wasn't all that bad. I got 3 meals a day and a mattress, and if I hadn't gone there, I never would have met your brother." When I followed Sarah to the sink to clean my empty glass, she thanked me and smiled in her generous way. Then she wished me good night and turned to go. "Sister Sarah," I said. When she turned back, she raised her eyebrows in inquiry. Then she watched with that same muted surprise as I reached into the pocket of her robe and removed the little brown bottle. "Trust me," I said. "These won't do you any good." And when she walked out of the kitchen, I stuck the bottle in the bottom of the spice rack, feeling like I'd done my second good deed of the day.
4. Wooly. On Friday at 1:30, Wooly was standing in his absolute favorite spot in the store. And that was really saying something, because at FAO Schwartz, there were so many wonderful spots to stand in. Why, to get to this spot, he had to pass through the collection of giant stuffed animals, including the tiger with the hypnotizing eyes, and the life-size giraffe whose head nearly hit the ceiling. He had to pass through motorsports, where two boys were racing little Ferraris around a figure-eight track. And at the top of the escalator, he had to pass through the magic set area, where a magician was making the Jack of Diamonds disappear. But even with all of that to see, there was nowhere in the store that made Wooly quite as happy as the big glass case with the dollhouse furniture. 20 feet long, with 8 glass shelves, it was even bigger than the trophy case in the gym at St. George's, and it was filled from bottom to top and side to side with perfect little replicas. On the left side of the case was a whole section dedicated to Chippendale furniture, with Chippendale highboys and Chippendale desks and a dining room set with 12 Chippendale chairs neatly arranged around a Chippendale table. The table was just like the one that his family used to have in the dining room of their brownstone on 86th Street. Naturally, they didn't eat at the Chippendale every day. It was reserved for special occasions like birthdays and holidays, when they would set the table with the best china and light all the candles in the candelabra. At least, that is, until Wooly's father died, and his mother remarried, moved to Palm Beach, and donated the table to the Women's Exchange. Boy, had his sister Caitlin gotten mad about that. "How could you?" she had said to their mother, or sort of shouted, when the moving men appeared to pick up the set. "That was great-grandma's." "Oh, Caitlin," replied his mother, "what could you possibly want with a table like that?
some fusty old thing that seats a dozen people? No one even gives dinner parties anymore. Isn't that right, Wooly? At the time, Wooly hadn't known whether people gave dinner parties or not. He still didn't know, so he hadn't said anything. But his sister had said something. She had said it to him as the moving men carried the Chippendale out the door. "Take a good hard look, Wooly," she said, "because you'll never see a table like that again." So he had taken a good hard look. But as it turned out, Caitlin had been wrong, for Wooly had seen a table like that again. He had seen it right here in the display case at FAO Schwartz. The furniture in the display case was arranged chronologically. So as you moved from left to right, you could travel all the way from the Court of Versailles to a living room in a modern-day apartment, with a phonograph and a cocktail table and a pair of Mies van der Rohe chairs. Wooly understood that Mr. Chippendale and Mr. van der Rohe were held in the highest esteem for the designs of their chairs. But it seemed to him that the men who made these perfect little replicas deserved at least as much esteem, if not more. For to make a Chippendale or a van der Rohe chair in such tiny dimensions surely had to be harder than to make one you could sit on. But Wooly's favorite part of the case was all the way over to the right, where there was a series of kitchens. At the top, there was what was called the prairie kitchen, with a simple wooden table and a buttered churn and a cast-iron frying pan on a cast-iron stove. Next came the Victorian kitchen. You could tell this was the sort of kitchen in which a cook did the cooking, because there was no table or chairs at which to sit and eat your supper. Instead, there was a long wooden island, over which hung six copper pots in descending order of size. And finally, there was the kitchen of today, with all the wonders of the modern era. In addition to a bright white stove and a bright white refrigerator, there was a table for four with a red formica top and four chrome chairs with red vinyl seats. There was a KitchenAid mixer and a toaster with a little black lever and two little pieces of toast. And in the cabinet over the counter, you could see all the little boxes of cereal and the tiny cans of soup. "I knew I'd find you here." Wooly turned to discover his sister standing at his side. "How did you know?" he asked in surprise. "How did I know?" repeated Sarah with a laugh. And Wooly laughed too, because of course, he knew exactly how she knew. When they were younger, every December, Grandma Wolcott would take them to FAO Schwartz so that they could each pick out their own Christmas present. One year, as the family was getting ready to leave with all of their coats buttoned and all of the big red bags filled to the limit, they realized that in the midst of the holiday bustle, young Wooly had somehow gone missing. Members of the family were dispatched to every floor, calling out his name, until Sarah finally found him here. "How old were we then?" She shook her head. "I don't know. It was the year before Grandma died, so I suppose I was 14 and you were 7. Wooly shook his head. "That was so hard, wasn't it?" "What was so hard?" "Choosing a Christmas present. From here, of all places." Wooly waved his arms about in order to encompass all of the giraffes, Ferraris, and magic sets in the building. "Yes," she said. "It was very hard to choose. But especially for you." Wooly nodded. "And then after," he said, "after we had picked out our presents and Grandma had sent the bags home with the driver, she would take us to the plaza for tea. Do you remember?" "I remember. We would sit in that big room with the palm trees, and they would bring those towers with the little watercress and cucumber and salmon sandwiches on the lower levels, and the little lemon tarts and chocolate eclairs on top. And Grandma would make us eat our sandwiches before we ate the cakes." "You have to climb your way to heaven." Wooly laughed. "Yes, that was it. That's what Grandma used to say." As Wooly and Sarah came off the escalator onto the ground floor, Wooly was explaining his brand new notion that the dollhouse chair makers deserved just as much regard, if not more, than Mr. Chippendale and Mr. van der Rohe. But as they were approaching the front door, someone was shouting urgently behind them. Excuse me, sir. When Wooly and his sister looked back to see the source of the commotion,
they discovered that a man with a very managerial appearance was chasing after them with a hand in the air.
"Just a moment, sir,"
the man called as he worked his way definitively in Wooly's direction. Intending to wear an expression of comic surprise, Wooly turned to his sister. But she was still watching the man approach with a slight hint of dread. A slight but heartbreaking hint. Reaching them, the man paused to catch his breath, then addressed Wooly.
"I apologize most sincerely for the shouting, but you've forgotten your bear."
Wooly's eyes opened wide.
"The bear!"
He turned to his sister, who looked at once mystified and relieved.
"I'd forgotten the bear," he said with a smile.
A young woman who had been trailing after the manager now appeared, holding a panda that was almost as big as she was.
"Thank you both," said Wooly, taking the bear in his arms. "Thank you 10 times over.
As the two employees returned to their stations, Sarah turned to Wooly.
"You bought a giant panda? It's for the baby."
"Wooly," she said with a smile and a shake of the head.
"I considered the grizzly and polar bears," Wooly explained, "but they both seemed a little too fierce."
By way of illustration, Wooly would have liked to raise his claws and bare his teeth, but his arms were too full of the panda. His arms were so full of the panda that he couldn't get through the revolving door. So the man in the bright red uniform, who always stands guard at the entrance of F.A.O. Schwartz, leapt into action.
"Allow me," he said gallantly.
Then he opened the unrevolving door to let the brother, sister, and bear onto the little terrace that separated the store from Fifth Avenue. It was a beautiful day, with the sun shining down on all the horse carriages and hot dog carts lined along the edge of Central Park.
"Come sit with me a moment," said Sarah, in a manner that suggested a serious conversation was coming.
A little reluctantly, Wooly followed his sister to a bench and sat down, placing the panda between them. But Sarah lifted the panda and put it to her side so that there was nothing between them.
"Wooly," she said, "there's something I want to ask you." As she looked at him, Wooly could see in her face an expression of concern, but also an expression of uncertainty, as if suddenly she wasn't sure that she wanted to ask him whatever it was that she had wanted to ask after all. Reaching out, Wooly laid his hand on her forearm. "You don't have to ask me something, Sarah. You don't have to ask me anything."
Looking at her, Wooly could see the feeling of concern continuing to struggle with the feeling of uncertainty. So he did his best to reassure.
"Questions can be so tricky," he said, "like forks in the road. You can be having such a nice conversation, and someone will raise a question, and the next thing you know, you're headed off in a whole new direction. In all probability, this new road will lead you to places that are perfectly agreeable, but sometimes you just want to go in the direction you were already headed."
They were both silent for a second. Then Wooly squeezed his sister's arm from the excitement of an additional thought.
"Have you ever noticed," he said, "have you ever noticed how so many questions begin with the letter W?"
He counted them off on his fingers.
"Who, what, why, when, where, which?"
He could see his sister's concern and uncertainty lifting for a moment as she smiled at this fascinating little fact.
"Isn't that interesting?" he continued. "I mean, how do you think that happened? All those centuries ago when words were first being coined, what was it about the sound of the W that made the word coiners use it for all of the questions, as opposed to, say, the T or the P? It makes you feel sort of sorry for W, doesn't it? I mean, it's a pretty big burden to carry, especially since half the time when someone asks you a question with a W, they aren't really asking you a question. They're making a statement in disguise, like,
Wooly adopted the posture and tone of their mother.
"When are you going to grow up? And why would you do such a thing? And what in God's name were you thinking?"
Sarah laughed, and it was good to see her do so, because she was a great laugher. She was the absolutely best laugher Wooly had ever known.
"All right, Wooly, I'm not going to ask you a question. Now she was the one who reached out a hand to take a forearm. Instead, I want you to make me a promise. I want you to promise that after your visit, you'll go back. Wooly wanted to look down at his feet, but he could feel her fingers on his forearm, and he could see in her face that though her concern remained, the expression of uncertainty was gone. I promise, he said. I promise that I'll go back. Then she squeezed his forearm just as he had squeezed hers, and looking like a great weight had been lifted from her shoulders, she leaned back on the bench, so he did the same. And as they sat there beside the panda, they found themselves looking across Fifth Avenue, right at the Plaza Hotel. With a big smile, Wooly stood and turned to his sister. We should go have tea, he said, for old time's sake. Wooly, Sarah said with a slump of the shoulders, it's after 2 o'clock. I still need to pick up my dress at Bergdorf's, have my hair done, and get back to the apartment so I can change in time to meet Dennis at Le Pavillon. Oh, blah, 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 said Wooly. Sarah opened her mouth to make another point, but Wooly picked up the panda and waggled it back and forth in front of his sister. Oh, blah, 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 he said in a panda's voice. All right, said Sarah with a laugh. For old time's sake, let's have tea at the plaza.